Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another collaboration between Pondering Soul and Darwinian Delusions. I have a big smile on my face, but today we're actually talking about a topic that's quite grim, especially because a lot of people in the last session about a week ago, this is on nihilism. Yusuf Pontus, he actually studied philosophy. He is in he's a convert to Islam from atheism, and this was his thesis. Now, in the last session, if you missed it, I would recommend you go and watch it. However, what we're doing today is a standalone topic as part of the dissertation, so you're free to watch it. And what we're going to be covering today is Nietzsche's nihilism. So, Yusuf, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. I know.
So let's get started on. Let's sort of do a recap of what we did last time, and then how it segues into today's session.
Yeah. So last week, from top of my head, we were speaking about the meaning of meaning, the issue with meaning, its importance, how it can drive societies in particular directions, and cause massive events, and then we gave like a little mini critique of utilitarianism, how meaning itself is distinct from pleasure and happiness, and that this is a driving force for mankind, not happiness, not necessarily anyway. It's only recently, more recently anyway, that this idea of happiness and pleasure that's kind of manifested itself. Prior to this, for the past however many centuries, meaning was the main driving force, and pleasure and happiness, it was maybe only available to the stupidly wealthy. And you know, so there's this kind of morphing recently, where these new ideas have been developing, and because there's all of this technology and success in terms of advancement, they're kind of trying to say that because these are parallel, they've got some sort of correlation. But I don't think it's necessarily so. I think suffering itself can give rise to meaning. And basically, there's a massive neglect of this subject of nihilism. And it needs to be confronted pretty much, especially within the Islamic community as well, because this is something that they're going to have to deal with at some point in the future. You know, even from our own eschatology, you know, towards the end of times, when the Dajjal is ready to appear, he'll have created a world which ultimately, for all intents and purposes, will be a nihilistic one. And so we need to understand that, and we need to prepare for it. And Nietzsche had some very good insights into that. So he is not a theist. He is, the way he talks, you'd think he was pretty agnostic about it. He actually says that it might very well be the case that God exists. He isn't trying to argue for a proof of God. He's not trying to argue in favor of atheism. He doesn't care what you believe, and he doesn't care what the truth of the matter is, whether or not there is a God or not. What he's basically doing is he's looking at this historical malady that's playing out from the time of Socrates onwards, and he sees it as this kind of drive to nihilism, and that this is the direction that it, like he was talking about European nihilism, but I think it can rightfully be applied globally, that this is something that will occur everywhere. And one of the main reasons is that there's certain conditions that I think we didn't actually mention this last week, but it's probably nice to mention it now. If I can just find it, there's a number of things which, bear with me, I'll tell you, I'll just read this short paragraph that kind of gets this point across. So Phoenix, an author, further points out that unfortunately the perennial threat to meaning is intensified under conditions of modern industrial civilization. The four factors that are listed as threats are: number one, the spirit of criticism and skepticism, which dominate the domains of science and philosophy, among many other fields. Number two, the tendency towards depersonalization and the fragmenting of complex societies due to industrialization and alienation. Number three, the overabundance of both things and information, inevitably overwhelming the modern citizen. And then last of all, number four, rapid rates of change, which leave constant feelings of impermanence and a lack of security. All of these factors contribute towards a sense of meaninglessness and the experience of an inner void, which can also further contribute to rates of suicide, depression, and substance abuse in a society. So,
sorry, who was that? Who said that?
Phoenix. So not, Phoenix, yeah. If you have a look on my dissertation, it's notes 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16. The paragraph that contains those footnotes, that's the one that I've just read out. And that's towards the end of the first section of part one, which is the section on meaning, the one that we went over last week. Towards the end of that.
That was quite good. That was quite good, I think.
Yeah. And it really highlights why the modern era in particular is distinct from the times previous. So, for example, prior to, say, over a century ago, rates of change weren't that much, or they weren't so quick. Today, in my 30 years, I've experienced a drastic change each decade. The decade that in the 90s, that was a very different decade to the 2000s, which is a very different decade to the past 10 years that has just occurred, which I'm going to make a prediction here, is going to be very different to the decade that's following. That's coming now. And back in the day, people could be pretty sure that the world that their grandchildren were going to inherit wasn't going to be that different than the world that their grandparents had to live in. Things occurred very slowly. You know, people, for the most part, especially like centuries ago, the world didn't change very much or very often. And there was a security in that. It wasn't necessarily a nice world. You know, there was a lot of struggle and pain and things like that. But there was, you know, the world was still the same. It was still recognizable. That, you know, they could become familiar with it. They could become comfortable with it. And with that familiarity and that comfortability, you could say that you know enough about it in order to be able to pass that information down to the generation that follow. Now, the difference is in a world where change is so rapid, this is an issue. You don't even know the world that you lived in now, because it's already different to the world that was in existence 10 years ago. And yeah, we don't have this time to be able to become comfortable with the world we live in, because by the time we become comfortable, it's gone. Rates of change have become exponential, and this is weird. And the human being has never had to deal with this, and we're just at the moment with this kind of technology. They keep going on about how great it is, but we're test dummies here. We're guinea pigs. Like, humans haven't had to deal with this kind of stuff before. And we've just been thrown into it. And is the internet connection all right on your end? It's just come up with a bit.
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah. So we've just been thrown into it. The human beings haven't had to deal with anything like this before. And we're just building things and producing things without any question as to whether or not it's good. And actually good, not just pleasurable, not just making a few people happy, you know, for a certain amount of time. And we're dealing with these consequences now. So, like, for example, and this is pretty much, it's kind of pushed by capitalism a lot as well. Like, insofar as a company can become successful, there's motivation to invest more into it. And you look at the development of, say, gaming over the years. And games have become incredibly enthralling, to the point where and we're letting our children play these very early. And so you have these kids, and a lot of this issue is mainly with young men or young boys, where they get to grow up in a world that, where they fight dragons, they can cast spells and like live in a castle and become the king of the world. And then you take them out of that and you throw them into a dusty classroom with a teacher who doesn't want to be there, and then try to tell them, listen, you've got to learn geometry. Like, memorize this, right? We're going to read the Scarlet Letter, or we're going to watch Kes the Kestrel. Like, things are boring in comparison, and we're wondering why they can't concentrate in schools, and why you have this massive increase in things like ADHD and children with behavioral problems. And it, like, you're showing them one world, which is incredible, you know. And the kids are playing. I was playing Grand Theft Auto way before I was 18. The second that came out, I had a copy of it. And Grand Theft Auto 3, the things you could do in that were mental. You were robbing cars, you were robbing banks. You could pull over at the corner and like prostitutes would jump into your car. There was the mad things. And then you go from doing all of this crazy stuff to going to a school. It's a nightmare waiting to happen. And then, so those 4 points that I've missed out, the spirit of criticism and skepticism, which dominate the domains of science and philosophy, it's become a common theme throughout Western society, where everyone's just skeptical of everything apart from their own skepticism. But the thing is that you become so skeptical of all these things that you leave yourself without really a foundation to kind of move from. The second point, the tendency towards depersonalization and the fragmenting of complex societies due to industrialization and alienation. If you've ever worked in a big... Say that again, sorry?
That's basically urbanization.
Yeah. Right. And even with factories and things like that, this kind of mass workplace. If you've ever worked in a call center, you get this weird desk thing that goes on, but everyone's pretty much in their own little bubble. There's not much communication going on beyond that. And you embody the spirit of the company you work for. So I used to work for Tesco Mobile, and like you become Tesco Mobile. When someone on the phone is angry at Tesco Mobile, you feel like they're angry at you. Like you lose yourself in your work. You become this entity, which is not you. Yeah. It's something bigger than you. And then you get the same problem in estates, where people can live together for years and they don't even know their own neighbors. They don't speak to them. People can live in the same household as each other and they might never see each other because everyone's just in their own rooms, stuck on their devices. And this is all in line with this kind of alienation. Point three was overabundance of both things and information, inevitably overwhelming the modern citizen. When you have too much, it can be difficult to make a choice. When you go into a restaurant, they have too many options. You don't know what you're supposed to pick. And then you'll always end up feeling like you've missed out or like you could have made a better choice. And with too much information, it's impossible for the human being to process all of it. It's impossible. And it's really funny as well, because we talk about, we know it more now than we've ever done before. It's like, what do you mean we know? Like, what is it that you know more than the person that lived 200 years ago? You feel as though because you live in the society that you can sort of take claim for the knowledge that society has. It's similar to like nationalism or sports, we're the best football team in the world. What do you mean we? You're not on the pitch. You're not running around kicking balls. You're just sat up in the podium or behind the telly screaming at it, getting sweaty. You're not doing nothing for it. It's not we. It's like there's this weird kind of, again, this depersonalization. You become this entity. There's a similar effect with religions as well. And you know, it's this kind of transfers over to non-religious things, which is why non-religious things can tend to kind of look very religious. And then the last one was rapid rates of change, which I've already gone through. This creates feelings of impermanence and a lack of security. And so all of these things contribute to meaninglessness. And if you look at how much all of these four factors have increased exponentially today, more so than they ever have in the past, you can also see why we have more of a problem with meaninglessness. And the question of what is the meaning of life didn't really start to arise until secularism. Doesn't even sound like a word anymore.
Yeah.
Is that it? Secularism. Yeah. The question of the meaning of life didn't really take hold until that came about. And it was, and it's to do with this kind of like people never had the chance or the opportunity to really ask what the meaning of life was. They just had jobs to do. They had to get up at the crack of dawn, go bed at night. And between those hours, there was no time for questioning things. There wasn't time for skepticism. There wasn't time to like do anything other than what needed to be done to provide. And with this kind of rise of the modern society, we've got more free time than ever. kids, mothers and housewives and things like that, if they want to wash clothes, they take the basket to the washing machine and they just throw them in and press a button, throw a couple of cups of this in, and then bish, bash, bosh. The washing machine does the rest of it. Back in the day, if you needed to wash your clothes, you had to go down to the river, get the water, get your board, and you had to scrub each one individually till your fingers were raw. And it took hours. It wasn't a beep, 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 dishwashers. All the dishes go in there, you press a button, done. Like a lot of these jobs, hoovers, like, do a good job at picking things up. And I'm not trying to say that all of these combined, it's still not difficult relative to the current moment. But you know, things are much easier now than they ever have been. We have got more free time than ever, and we don't know what to do with it. So we ask these questions that we never used to have to ask. And this itself gives rise to problems. So now moving on to what is nihilism, which is section two of part one of my dissertation. And I begin basically by outlining Nietzsche asked the question, what is nihilism? And he gives a couple of quick short summaries of what it is. He says, what is nihilism? There is no goal and there is no answer to the question why. And then he asks, what is the significance of nihilism? The highest values devalue themselves. And then it's a bit of a weird sentence. What does it mean to say that the highest values have devalued themselves? And what people, especially the modern atheists, they like to kind of look at this whole science thing as the development of a scientific spirit, which then kind of started to battle with the Christian spirit or with the religious spirit, and that it defeated it and overcome it, and that it's this new thing. And this for Nietzsche is wrong. He doesn't see science as something that was new and that defeated Christianity. He sees science as the result of Christianity making truth the highest value, the highest commitment. And that this commitment to truth as the highest value eventually turned its sting upon itself, which is to say that it undermines itself. And what you end up with is our age. Yeah, so it's basically the victory of the Christian conscience against itself, and the Christian will to truth turning its sting against itself. And science is the remains of Christianity, which are basically the development of this, what he referred to as the death of God. And the death of God was very well put out in the aphorism of the madman, which it might be good to read if you don't mind.
No, I think it's I think I mentioned this before we started, that a lot of people, they've heard a very simple version of that, so it'd be nice to get that properly fleshed out.
So it's in a book that's got a funny name, The Gay Science, and it's aphorism 125, and it's only a page and just over a page. It's really small. Yep. So it's called The Madman, and it goes as follows. So, haven't you heard of the madman who, in the bright morning, lit a lantern and ran around the marketplace crying incessantly, "I'm looking for God, I'm looking for God." Since many of those who did not believe in God were standing around together just then, he caused great laughter. "Has he been lost then?" asked one. "Did he lose his way like a child?" asked another. "Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone to sea, emigrated?" Thus they shouted and laughed, one interrupting the other. The madman jumped into their midst, pierced them with his eyes. "Where is God?" he cried. "I'll tell you. We have killed him, you and I. We are all his murderers. But how did we do this? How were we able to drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Where is it moving to now? Where are we moving to? Away from all suns? Are we not continually falling and backwards, sideways, forwards in all directions? Is there still an up? Is there still a down? Aren't we straying as though through an infinite nothing? Isn't empty space breathing at us? Hasn't it got colder? Isn't night and more night coming again and again? Don't lanterns have to be lit in the morning? Do we still hear nothing of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we still smell nothing of the divine decomposition? God's too decompose. God is dead. God remains dead. And we have killed him. How can we console ourselves? The murderers of all murderers, the holiest and the mightiest thing that the world has ever possessed, has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood from us? With what water could we clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what holy games will we have to invent for ourselves? Is the magnitude of this deed not too great for us? Do we not ourselves have to become gods merely to appear worthy of it? There was never a greater deed, and whoever is born after us will, on account of this deed, belong to a higher history than all history up to now. Here the madman fell silent and looked again at his listeners. They too were silent and looked at him disconcertedly. Finally, he threw his lantern on the ground so that it broke into pieces and went out. "I have come too early," he said. "My time is not yet. This tremendous event is still on its way, wandering. It has not yet reached the ears of men. Lightning and thunder need time. The light of the stars needs time. Deeds need time, even after they are done, in order to be seen and heard. This deed is still more remote to them than the remotest stars, and yet they have done it themselves. It is still recounted how on the same day the madman forced his way into several churches and there started singing his requiem at Aeternum Deo. Led out and called to account, he is said always to have replied nothing but, 'What then are these churches now, if not the tombs and sepulchres of God?'" And so that's the aphorism of the madman. And Nietzsche, he's very good. Like, he wrote in aphorisms, which are these like really short accounts, and he was really good at painting a picture. And with this particular aphorism, I think it's one of his most famous one, but it outlines this idea of nihilism really well. And this idea that, because to begin with, the people are just laughing, they're just joking, they're not really taking him seriously. They're even mocking him. And he doesn't stand for it. He looks serious enough so that they all turn silent and they listen to him. They hear him out. And there's such a truth to what he's saying that they can't help but fear what he said. Like, and at the end of it, they're very somber. Yeah, they're not mocking him anymore. And the bit right at the end where he says he's running into the churches and he's saying, what are these but the tomb of Christianity? Like, you see that today. You see these churches being torn down, people don't turn up to them, and you'll maybe get a few elderly people that will turn up for tea and biscuits on a Sunday. And for the most part, they're just these empty buildings. And there's certain parts of the world, like if you go into Africa and certain evangelical parts of America, and even South America, these are still vibrant, but they're not so much in Europe anymore. You need to go really, really far East Europe. And in the major cities, there's this nihilism that takes hold. And this is basically a way of him describing this this void that's left in the absence of this religious system. And the way he talks about it is that he says they don't realize what they've done. Deeds take time. Even the light of a star takes time to reach you. And they've acted something out, and they don't realize its consequences, but they continue to act it out. And yeah. You see these consequences. This guy died in the 1900s. He stopped writing in 1890. And he was like, that aphorism as well, I think, is one of Jordan Peterson's favorite ones. He talks about it a lot. And it's very telling, because you read that and it seems extremely relevant today. You feel like we're very much these people in the courtyard. They're running around, they're laughing, they're joking.
Yeah, I like to think of Nietzsche as a secular prophet. a prophet without revelation. He just made a very clear, precise prediction, which we're seeing actualized now. You know, the madman says, "I've come too early." And now's the time that, I think about the rise of Jordan Peterson. He only filled a void. He didn't create a void. He only filled a void. And that's why overnight he went from being a relative nobody to being somebody that even atheists follow, because he speaks about meaning and purpose and value and hope and, you know, these types of things. So, yes, yeah,
with Jordan Peterson, he's basically the father figure that has been lost as a result of this attachment to freedom and this lack of responsibility, where people, specifically young men, because that is his major demographic, is yeah. young males. The world has become so drunk on this idea of freedom that they're no longer, they no longer have this idea of committing to family, to community, to any of this. It's about what can I do for myself? And yeah. this is emphasized by this mass, this kind of obsession with being unique, being individual. There's consequences to this. What you end up with is a fractured society where people generally tend to focus on themselves more than anything. A really good example, there was someone, I won't mention names or anything like that, but someone that I knew was debating what to do with the last tenner that they had, whether to go out and get drunk or to buy nappies. Like, how is that something that would even arise in your mind as something that needs to be deliberated? Like, how can your obsession with being an individual and being free and enjoying yourself and trying to be happy and feel pleasure out trump your responsibility to making sure that your child has clean nappies? What,
you know, I was watching the Jeremy Kyle show and the same thing came up. I don't know why I was watching that program, and there's this mother who was not taking care of her child. And she was just a horrible mother. And Jeremy Kyle, when talking to her, she said that, oh, you know, I clean his nappies, you know, as if it was a big deed. And he turned around and he said to her, that's your job. Yeah. Why are you saying it like it's something special? And, you know, if you want to see a window, if you want to peek into our fractured society today, just watch the Jeremy Kyle show. Just watch these. Yeah. Just how you, I mean, this tenor thing and this thing about getting drunk. This isn't an anomaly. People it's are common. Making decisions all the time. I don't know if you know about Simone de Beauvoir. Yeah. She wrote The Second Sex, that feminist philosopher. And, you know, she says the house for a woman is a comfortable concentration camp, right? And she sees raising children as a type of oppression, right? Literally the social fabric of society is being absolutely torn away. If the mother doesn't recognize that I need to raise kids and the kids are my responsibility, then who on earth is going to do it? our entire society is just becoming more and more isolated.
Well, this is just incredible. Yeah, definitely. And this is the whole, a value turning its sting upon itself. So this need for freedom and this need for being an individual and being unique kicks its own legs from underneath itself. I can't remember if it was in private on one of our recordings. I mentioned when I was at Full Moon Party, you have all these people and they're like, yeah, we're so unique. I'm just an individual. And they just look like coral. Like, they're all dancing. They look like one organism. And like, if everyone is trying to be unique, none of you are unique. You're all trying to do the same. All become like the same. Like, it doesn't, you can dress it in different aesthetics, you can wear a different color, you all have the same goal, you all have the same aim, you're all being the same in trying to be different.
You know, I'll tell you something funny about that. There's a brother called Nadeem Ashraf. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's an amazing dai who teaches people how to stop people in the street in terms of giving dawah. And I've seen him, he can literally stop anybody and start giving them dawah. And he said something really interesting to me about this. He said, the way you stop someone on the street and convey Islam to them is first you need to get their attention. So you can't say to them, do you believe in God or purpose? Like, forget that. The gist of what he's saying is, the first thing you need to do is understand everybody is leaving their house with the same purpose, regardless of whether they are a businessman or a single mom, whoever they are. And they're leaving the house with the purpose of being noticed, right? So all you need to do is notice them and say, hey, that's a nice jacket. Hey, where did you get that from? Oh, you're looking quite smart today. And instantly you grab their attention. When you grab their attention, you just take the conversation where you want to take it. And it's exactly like you said, you know, everybody thinks they're unique, they're different, they're free, but we're all bound by the same needs. If not, we may not look the same, but we all have the same base desires.
Yeah. And people who are able to extract that common thread that is in each human being become great at dealing with people. There was another guy, I used to work in a call center trying to sell contracts for Vodafone, cold calling. And I hated it. I was there for like a year or something, but it was difficult. Like, you're ringing people and you've got to try and convince them to stay on the phone when they're not expecting your call, and then to give you money and to buy products that they don't necessarily need. Like, we were trying to get them to take SIM-only contracts for their children that were on pay-as-you-go. That was the main demographic. Oh, you're spending how much on pay-as-you-go SIM cards for your children? Get this SIM-only. You know, you'll save so much money. And it was really difficult. But there was this one guy, and he was an absolute master at selling to people. And no one could figure out like what it was that he was doing. And people would try to imitate him, but they would imitate him in such a way that it would always become really dodgy and end up breaking some sort of rule. And the way he did it was always within the confines of what was okay. And it was like he was hypnotizing his customers, and he was that good. They constantly tried to get everyone to listen into his calls. And the way he would do it, he would just basically tell the customer, like, he would speak to them. He had this very hypnotic voice. You are going to take these contracts. They will save you money. And then the people would just be like, okay. And he's like, now I'm going to, and then he just start reading out the, because the worst bit in the sales was having to read out the terms and conditions.
And
it was really difficult to keep people while you were doing it. And so you would try to rush them. You would just try to skip over the bits that might make them question. This was years ago. I was like 18 or something, maybe 19. He didn't rush. He would even talk really slowly through the terms and conditions, and he'd kill it. We were targeted at like 5. People would usually maybe get 2 or 3, and it was, you know, you'd have to really try to get that target. And he'd be getting like 10, 11, 20. And you're like, what is it you're doing? And he just knew. He'd abstracted how to deal with the human being on such a way that he could just talk to whoever he wanted, and he'd get them to take contracts out they didn't need in high numbers for friends. He'd make people take contracts out for a mate. Like, I was struggling to get people to take them out for the family members. Like, it was really weird. But yeah, certain people can get, like, they can delve under the carpet and see the mechanics, the underlying.
And you know, you really have to understand psychology if you're going to be a caller to Allah. You know, Allah says in the Quran that He sent a prophet to every nation in their language. Now, the scholars say that the language refers to culture here as well, because of course language is a reflection of culture. When you've been born in a city and you start to read the air, you start to realize, okay, what is it about? Other people will realize that. So a common theme that Londoners recognize is loneliness, right? That London is actually one of the bigger cities in Europe, but it's actually a city with a massive problem with loneliness. Now, I was looking up on the National Health Service, NHS website. Loneliness is actually considered a health crisis. It's an early indicator of death. And it's actually something which a lot of people suffer from. Now, when you're in a very big city, you think you're actually surrounded by people, but you're not. You're actually almost like in a desert on your own. The only difference is it's far, far worse, because rather than you being in an empty room, you're in a room full of people who you don't know. And if we as Muslims learn to crack this code, if we learn to understanding their psyche, that they want, they're lonely, and use that to convey Islam to them, use that to ultimately make them realize, look, this life is about having a relationship with Allah. Because Islam, you know, when people ask me what is Islam, I just tell them Islam's a relationship. That's all it is. Because you know, you start telling people Islam is worship or submission, they don't understand what you're saying. But if you just say relationship, it's a relationship between you and God, right? Then they start understanding, okay, relationship, okay, that means I need to worship God in this particular way, or this type of thing. And A few years ago, I attended, have you heard of this course called the Alpha Course?
I think you've mentioned it to me.
Did I mention it on the live time, or was it just...
I think it was in a private conversation. Was it the Christian missionaries?
Yeah, so it's Christian missionary course. You must have heard of Bear Grylls, that guy who goes around eating frogs and surviving in the... Yeah, that guy. So he's also an Alpha graduate. So Alpha is a Christian course that basically attracts people, fallen Christians, even atheists, agnostics. It started off in London and took off in the whole world. But basically, I attended that and I did some research on that with another brother from my era. And we attended their sessions and their what they do. What was really interesting is the first thing they said to us is, on Alpha, you're going to make friends. That's a very odd thing to say, because they're supposed to be selling us Christianity. However, what I started to realize is that every week you would be in the same group, you'd socialize with the same group of people, and after the session, you'd be more than welcome to go out with them. So if you were just lonely in a big city, Alpha is a way of making friends, because a lot of people don't really have friends. And I just thought, oh my God, no wonder why this course is so, it's the most successful, I believe, Christian course in the Western world, from the perspective that, okay, take out North American Christianity, at least in Europe, because when I was reading up the statistics, it started off in London, I think, in the 80s or something. And now it's gone to the whole world, and it's been, people have attended in millions the entire 12-week course. And all they've done is they've hacked into this idea that human beings are lonely.
Yeah, they're providing for need.
That's it. That's it, yeah.
Because
not reason.
Say it again?
That people are lonely. That is nihilism. That, you know, people in a big city, the social fabric has broken down and they don't really have friends, and then they start having too much time to think to themselves, which leads to depression and leads to meaningless, to a life without meaning.
It's interesting as well, because see all of this thing to do with friendship, meaning, I mentioned before, these are all subjective. These are subjective things. And with, so we were talking about, just kind of bring it back to the thread that we were on. We mentioned that the will to truth was a commitment and an absolute moral claim, and that this began with religion. And it basically, rather than it being science versus Christianity, it was science became what it is today as a result of the death of Christianity's faith in God. And the only reason science was able to become as successful as it had was because it inherited this absolute claim for the will to truth. And with that, what it's very symbolic of Christianity giving up its faith, not just in God, but in the transcendental in general. And it's this idea of truth. It became a very strange one. It became a very particular kind of truth. So within science, it's not so much that they value truth, but they value truth which can be manipulated. So they value the truths that you can make something with. You can produce something that can be used. It has utility. And you see this with modern science, its emphasis on kind of producing material things and making it so that you can live longer. And oh, if you're unhappy, don't worry about confronting the issues and trying to understand what is it that's causing your unhappiness. Have these pills that science has produced that will, you know, exactly. So it's flushing subjectivity out of the world, and it sees the universe as nothing but a collection of facts. And, you know, and these facts can...
Even those facts are subjective, because you've chosen to focus on those things that give you immediate gratification.
Yeah, well, there's still a value in them, and that value still derives from the subject. And whether or not you should value that over other things, it is a subjective decision. And so the way to understand it is that it occurs in layers. So it's not that we're denying objectivity, because I'm foreseeing now the atheist going, oh, he's saying everything's subjective, they're subjectivists. No, there's layers to things. You can have objective within the subjective within the objective. It's like saying if people were to make the claim now that we're being subjectivist, it's like looking at Einstein and his theory of relativity and calling him a relativist, and that, you know, that he had no he didn't believe in the objective. It's no, the theory of relativity is an objective structure, and within it there are contained elements of relativity, and then, you know, you can have like layers of, yeah, exactly, and then you can have a layer on top of that is that the only reason we've decided to value this particular objective structure is because of a subjective choice to, you know, favor one thing over another. And you don't need to make that choice. You could, if you wanted, just value deception if it's going to get you something better, or, you know, so on and so forth. So that's what we mean when we're saying, you know, it's a subjective thing. It's not that the whole structure itself is subjective and that we're denying any form of objectivity. But
That brings in a quick thing I just wanted to interject about Douglas Murray. Today, I was listening to him speak about Nietzsche and belief in God disappearing in Europe, and therefore people turning towards nihilism and that sort of thing. I don't remember exactly what he's saying, but anyway, he sort of mentioned that, you know, it's interesting that the people today who are calling for belief in Europe happen to be non-believers, so they want somebody else to do the believing, right? So even he himself is an atheist. He says something very interesting in, The Strange Death of Europe. He said, his book, right? So he says, the future of Europe will be decided by the way that we treat our churches. which is very interesting from an atheist.
Well, it's very, it kind of echoes the end of that, the madman aphorism, that they just become these, like, these tombs. Or even if you go to France, they're even just tourist attractions. Like, people go there to, like, ooh, look at this. It's become like another thing. Like, and people just go to look at it, or look at the beauty of it. It's, you know, it's this big fancy architectural wonder. Marvelous, but like the thing that motivated the drive to build these things in the first place wasn't atheistic. It was like a desire to reach the transcendental through the beauty of art. And, you know, whether or not that was the right way of going about it is another thing, but yeah, it's a weird one, because basically this will to truth and this will to a particular kind of truth eventually gave rise to a void. And the void itself is represented by, because the value, the higher values have devalued themselves, you're left with no value whatsoever. And when there's no value, there's no meaning. And pain has no purpose anymore. And...
Oh, yes, sorry. That's one thing we didn't cover today. We really need to delve into that in some detail.
So the whole pain is something that is going to occur in life. We all suffer. We all, you know, if you love, I got this from out of everything. I could have got it from How to Train Your Dragon. And there's a scene where it's basically kind of looking into the past, and the main character in it, the young lad that's got like a leg missing, he's sitting with his dad, and his dad looks at him and he says, his mother had died at some point, and he says, to love is to lose. Like if you love something, an integral part of that love is to understand that you're going to lose it at some point, and it entails loss. And this is a massive source of pain to think, because like if anyone who's got children and anyone who has any sort of temporal sense and they can look into the future, they instantly, you will notice that there will be a point or a time that will arise where someone is going to pass. Like in an ideal world, it's usually the elderly that pass first. It doesn't always happen that way. My granddad lost both of his sons, my father and my uncle, before he passed away. So he had to go to the funeral of his two children. And, you know, this is something that occurs for people. Sometimes you'll have a child, they might suffer, they might go through pain. And the pain that they experience is pain that you experience as a parent. And, you know, the other way around as well. So love itself, it's an amazing thing, and you know, alhamdulillah, but it carries with it this inevitable suffering that's going to come along, and everyone will lose someone, everyone will become ill, everyone will have to deal with pain and suffering in one way or another. Something that makes that easy to cope with is meaning. If you can make that suffering, that pain, meaningful, you will bear that pain, and you will do it with a straight back, like you'll crack on. If that pain becomes purposeless, if it becomes something that you know, is just an accident, that there's no meaning behind it, there's no greater purpose, it becomes something unbearable, like you can't. And this is nihilism. This is what people are having to deal with. If they could understand that their loneliness had a purpose, that, you know, that there was some sort of meaning behind it, maybe people would be able to deal with that a bit better.
Yeah.
And yeah. Go on. No, you were going to say something.
So I just stole, right? So David Stove is a philosopher that I love because he was very, very anti-Darwinian, and he wrote Darwinian Fairy Tales, which was a massive shock to his fans, right? Being an atheist philosopher challenging Darwin. However, when he started to suffer in his 60s because of some health issue, he completely bailed out and he just killed himself. And his book, for Darwinian Fairy Tales, was published after he died. And, you know, when I think about him, I get sad because I think, you know, people are dying to live. And here's a man who can't deal with a health issue and he just decides to top himself. You know?
Well, this life is truly. And this is what people that really, really want to push this bastardization of subjectivity and this overvaluing of objectivity, and basically what they're not understanding is there's a weird thing about objectivity. It's you can also refer to it as the perspectiveless perspective. That is, you take the position of a disinterested God and you look at the world from the perspective of this disinterested God, and then you try to explain it in terms of its material substrate. And to do so means to flush away the meaning of things. It means to flush away any subjectivity. It's to look at the world from a perspective that isn't the perspective of life. And that's an issue, because you can't escape the perspective of life, for one. So it's a bit of an oxymoron, the whole idea of a perspectiveless perspective. And
What do you mean by perspective of life? I don't understand what you meant by that.
So the perspective of life is basically subjectivity. The perspective of life is the perspective of a living being that is engaged in an environment, that is engaged in a life, that has a desire to, you know, to feel fulfilled in a meaningful way. And when you focus on this kind of objectivity, looking at the world objectively, and to flush it, you end up with these weird accidents that you get out of people like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who, when there was a massacre, he was like, oh, what you guys all getting all uppity about this massacre for? More people die because of the flu. And it's like, are you gonna say that to the people that have like just had their family murdered because of this? Or like, you know, when there's these school shootings and there's children that get shot up, right? So what if there's more people that die because of the flu? This is heartbreaking as well. But there's a difference between it, in the sense that people who die because of the flu, there's no maliciousness behind that. There's no hatred. The important thing is that there's this, the horror in a massacre is that there's a subjective perspective that wanted to commit an atrocity. That in itself is horrifying. Yes. And then there is this sense of justice or injustice. And these ideas of justice and injustice, they dissolve when you're thinking of the world from an objective perspective. Because justice is this, it's the subjective feeling of a being that is alive, that feels wronged. But like Dawkins says, you know, in this world without God, there's no right, there's no wrong, there's no justice, there's only pitiless indifference. And what he's talking about is, it's not that what he said is objectively true either, because it's not as if that detail itself is something that can be scientifically proven. It's that
it's a metaphysical statement. Yeah,
he's made an assumption that meaning is unimportant, and he might not even like that being said, because I doubt he will, because he's a human being. He would still find meaning important, but there's cognitive dissonance here. If you're promoting this idea of the perspectiveless perspective, of objectivity trumping subjectivity, of looking at the world simply as a collection of facts, then you've lost the meaning of it. Like, you've lost the reasons why we value things in the first place. And you're facilitating this kind of this nihilism that takes hold of people. So were you going to say something?
I was thinking about what a philosopher said about this. No, it wasn't about this topic, but there was this debate amongst these two philosophers about whether truth is intrinsically valuable or whether it's instrumentally valuable. Now, one of the examples the philosopher gave, I think his name is Trevor Hedberg, or he was the one challenging this other woman called Miriam, some other name. Anyway, basically what these two philosophers are going on about was the value of truth, right? Whether it's an end in of itself or whether it's just instrumental. So the example that was given was this. If you are Superman right now, you would have a window. You would find out who committed a murder. You wouldn't use those superpowers to count how many threads are in each carpet, in every carpet in the world, because that would be completely superfluous, right? So if truth was intrinsically valuable, then you would care just as much for that trivial piece of information as you would for finding out the truth about who committed a murder. But clearly, there is a subjective element which is the driving force here. You do care about who committed the murder and finding out the truth, and you don't really care about the threads in a carpet. Something like this, they had this long discussion. So it's the same thing as you're saying, that this idea that we can flush out the world without meaning, you're still focusing as a cosmologist or a physicist or a biologist on a particular subject which you have deemed valuable.
Yeah, and you've also deemed other things not valuable. But that's a choice. You've decided that, you know, what's important here is we need to flush away all this subjectivity. We need to get rid of the meaning so we can look at this objectively. But, like, why? Why? You've not given any arguments as to why this is more important than that. Like, and then they have to kind of confront this, because they push this for so long that you end up with Sam Harris going, oh, crap, we forgot about meaning. Quickly, write a book about something. Like, we need people to feel like they have a meaningful life again. And, you know, it's with Christianity, yeah, for centuries, Christianity gave that meaning to the West, and it did so insofar as there was a relationship to God, and that there, like, everything that you ever did had this eternal consequence. And, you know, there was something, every deed, no matter how small, was going to be rewarded or punished by an eternal being. And once you died, you know, these things carried that meaning forward even further. And when they lost that, you know, every deed, as little as it was completely pointless. And then all that mattered was all these big deeds. And even then, the meaning was only insofar as, you know, you were alive. And once you're dead, it doesn't really matter past that point. And that there are people, even though they're atheist, they might say, oh, well, no, I'm doing this for the people that are going to come in the future. And it's like, are you saying that because you mean it? Or are you saying that because you think other people might look at you as some sort of morally superior being now and judge you for that in a positive light? Are you saying that because you mean it, or because it's got some sort of benefit here now with the people around you? And
yeah, but it's the infinite regress problem, because you're not valuing yourself, you're valuing them. And you ask them, why are they valuing themselves? They're valuing something else. It's just, where does the buck stop at? You have to start somewhere.
Yeah. And so, as well, I think nihilism is something that we've always had to deal with. And the way Nietzsche puts it is Christianity was an antidote for nihilism. And that nihilism itself, I mentioned following on in this article, it's not a choice. So people, I think I mentioned this in the first, the one we did last week as well. People don't choose necessarily to become nihilist. There are people who do, and they'll go, yeah, I identify as a nihilist, man. But when you make the choice to become a nihilist, it's ultimately self-contradictory. Like, you're looking at the world through a meaningful lens insofar as you identify meaningfully as a nihilist. And so it's not a clever position to take. It's what he referred to as an intermediary pathological state. And basically, it's the consequence of the four things that I mentioned at the beginning. Life's meaning is taken away from you because of your condition, your societal condition. And what you're left with is a void. And this void has certain psychological effects on you. And the experience of this is what we're calling nihilism. And it can take a hold of individuals, but it's a societal issue. And it's a historical one that's moving like with us through time. And it's slowly kind of gathering globally. And so with this, it also invokes the immense generalization that life has no meaning whatsoever. And this immense generalization isn't a rational one. So to just say life has no meaning whatsoever, this is just like a reaction. It's not something that's necessarily thought out.
I don't understand that. Say that last part again. To say life has no meaning.
To make the immense generalization that no life has meaning.
Yeah.
that's not a reasoned response. It's a reaction to this experience. So if you say like all life has no meaning, you can't know that. It's not, you know what I mean? You don't. So it's not a rational statement. It's just, it's an outburst, an emotional outburst.
What you're saying is when confronted with nihilism, it seems like you're biting the bullet by saying yes, all meaningless, but that's not really like a sound position. That's just,
yeah. Well, you've not given any argumentation for it. You're just experiencing meaninglessness. It's subjective.
Kind of like those people who say, you know, well, what else is there? You know, it's not an argument. It's just,
yeah.
Like,
yeah. What's the point? Why should I do it? I was like, well, you're not giving an argument. You're just giving up. That's all you're giving. So, like,
I wanted to cover one last topic before you wrap up, and that is to do with when he says that Christianity was filling a void, and that in Europe they're going to need something in the future to replace it. Now, I was thinking about the analogy of bad times creates good people. Good people create good times. Good times creates bad people. And then bad people create bad times. Meaning from a tough environment, you get good people coming. And those good people, if they live a lavish life, then they become slobbish and they lead to bad times. And from those bad times, you get good people. It's like the cycle that of history that people speak about. So when I think about Christianity and the genesis of Christianity spread at the Colosseums, you know, where Christians were being fed to lions and Christians were being persecuted by giving meaning to suffering and people realizing, oh my God, this is such an empowering system. Before they themselves became the oppressors with the, you know, the colonization of Latin America and whatnot. But anyway, what Nietzsche seems to be pointing out is that, look, something's like this is going to happen in the future. However, Douglas Murray and Nietzsche, they both seem to be agreeing on one thing, if I've understood Nietzsche correctly, but Douglas Murray's definitely very clear on it. Douglas Murray said, look, we can't go back to unknowing what we know, unknowing what we know in terms of Darwinism, unknowing what we know in terms of 19th century German scholarship, which I think he was referring to the historical preservation of the Bible. We can't unknow that, so we can't go back to faith. And I think Nietzsche said something similar.
Yeah,
he says so. Firstly, am I right in understanding that Nietzsche?
Yeah, so he. The way he put it is that there's no returning to Christianity now. That nihilism is something that is an inevitable. It's arriving. It's inevitable. It's here already. Like he says in the aphorism of the madman, it's already arrived. We've just not noticed yet. And people are too busy going about, you know, gayfully joy, like laughing and being hedonists. You know, they're just going about mocking the world and laughing. And you see this. Is that one of the predictions as well of the end times? That people will begin to mock more than any
time? I don't know about that. I'm very careful with this because I've seen lots of stuff out there.
Yeah, Well, if someone can maybe find that out, and if there is one, leave it in the comments. That'd be interesting. I think I've heard something along that line. That there's something to do with people mocking is one of the signs of the end times.
But there is one thing which is very clear, right? Which is that materialism is obviously linked to nihilism from the perspective that a materialistic society, it necessarily needs to be a more individualistic society because materialist, you have to cut off the sort of cords of family and friends and anything else that gets in your way. And what we do know about the fitna of Dajjal is that he's going to attract the world through materialism. Now, I was thinking about something, right? So the Dajjal, when he comes, he's actually going to come on earth for a very short period of time. I don't remember the exact time, but a very short period of time. So the preparation to make the world materialistic needs to be in place before the Dajjal actually comes. Now, if the Dajjal came in the 16th century, it's quite interesting as a thought experiment. He won't really have much followers, even here in Europe or in North America or in Latin America or in Africa, because globally people were quite spiritual. Christianity was strong, Islam was strong, other faiths were strong, Confucianism and other stuff. It's interesting, the world wasn't really that materialistic only 400 years ago. Fast forward today, materialism is everywhere. You know, Chinese people have left Confucianism and Taoism and they're focusing on materialism. Europeans are the same. And probably, this is very interesting, in my experience of, alhamdulillah, being able to travel across the world, I have found no place to be more materialistic, I think, than the Middle East. These are my, I really, truly believe there is no place on earth that is as materialistic as the Middle East, even though they may say this is a Muslim country and whatnot. So how do we get to this again? Yeah, nihilism is materialism to deeply think about that, you know.
Sorry, you broke up. When, can you repeat that last bit?
Nihilism and its link to materialism is something we really need to think about. Because materialism is a type of escapism of nihilism, that if you just tell everybody, look, stop trying to accumulate more wealth, stop trying to increase in your status in society, stop doing all these things, let's stop and think about life, boom, nihilism is going to overtake you. But if you continuously are involved in the rat race, right, of life, you'll be able to actually escape nihilism, not completely, but to a large extent, blunt it out of your worldview.
One of the issues here as well is, if suffering is pointless, and if reflecting on your condition in the world is going to cause you suffering, because this is serious, like, one thing I've noticed is, like, when I'm with people that I generally know, they're not necessarily religious, and you're talking to them, if I'm not involving myself in the conversation, they act like they're people in the madman aphorism. They're just taking the mick out of each other. They're having fun. They're just trying to keep their mind off it. A lot of the people that live around me and that I know, and they engage in things like alcohol, and I'm only around them when I need to be. I don't, just so people know, I'm not getting involved in these drinking sessions or anything like that. Yeah. I'm only with them when I need to be. And then when I go, and then I spend time with my family. But, you know, I have access to this world, so I can see into it. And they're not really ever taking anything serious unless someone has done something wrong. And, you know, they'll take things seriously and there might be a bit of a kickoff. But it's a momentary seriousness. It's only like, you've stolen from me, or you've done something you shouldn't have done, and blah blah blah. It's all about, like, short end of justice. And I've got this habit of, like, I can't help but just talk about philosophy and, like, the meaning of life, and it can go one of two ways. Sometimes when I talk to certain people, I can see I'm annoying them. They don't want to talk about this stuff. It's just way too serious. And, you know, they'll avoid it, or they'll go into a bit of a mood, and you can see they're not enjoying the conversation. Other people, they you can see that they're thirsting for it. Like, you know, they've had dry mouth and I've just come along with this water, and I'm asking them things which are important, and that they, you know, they really do think are important, and they've got an opportunity to talk to someone. And like, there's one of my brother's mates. He might be watching this, actually. Hello, everyone. But he loves to come over and ask questions. And, like, every time he comes in, he's like, I've got another question for you. And I love it. I don't mind. Like, if people have got questions, I like to engage in that. But he loves it. And it's the same with a lot of people. And when you make them And it makes them serious for a moment. Yeah. And they're not just mocking and they're not just taking the mick. They're like, they're thinking about life and they're thinking about it fundamentally. And then I'll put them on their toes and I'll get them to think about death. Like, you know, you're going to die one day and you might even have to deal with the fact that you're going to know that it's approaching. Someone might tell you you're going to have cancer one day. You need to think about this. You need to really sit down and think about the moment that you're going to die and that what might happen after that and what might it be like building up to it. You need to think and look at the people that you care about, really care about, who you love, and think that they're going to die one day and that there's going to be suffering. And all of this that we have, it's like in the West, people can get into this state of mind where they think what they have, like the story of the man in the Quran, where he's got a garden. He's like, look at this garden. It's going to last. Yeah. This is, I can't imagine this would ever go. This is going to be here forever. And wow, look at me. Look at my position. Look at how great it is. And then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wills it gets taken away and it gets taken away. And then he goes, if only I didn't idolize my things. If only I didn't become so arrogant. If I had considered the fact that these things will go away. And with this society, the Western society, or this global society that we have at the moment, that thinks science is great, yeah, we've got all this technology. For all we know, we could just be at the peak and we're about to drop. And the Romans thought the same of themselves. They saw themselves as this mass. Look at us. We've got land all the way up to Scotland, all the way to the Middle East and beyond. You know, we own the world as far as they were concerned. And what happened to them in the end? They crumbled. Allah says, you know, look at the civilizations that came before you and see the ruins and see what became of them. And we're so arrogant with science that we see ourselves as invincible. We see ourselves, you know, as a society that will never end. And
Allah says in the Quran to the Quraysh, to the disbelieving pagans, have they not considered that their end of life may be near? You know, and the idea of being temporal is so powerful. I was literally today, after I think Maghrib or something, I was thinking about Quranic verse Surah Teen, you know, Watini wa Zaytun. So that surah deals with the idea that we created man in the highest of forms and we will reduce him to the lowest of the low. And Allah gives the example of this life being like a plant which first looks really pleasing to the onlookers, and then slowly it gets old and wrinkly and then just dry and just disappears. So, you know, I know exactly what you mean when you get these vast majority of people, you try and start a conversation, even Muslims, you try and start a conversation about the fighter. People get put off straight away. But I know exactly that feeling. They're just like, they just tell you that through their, you know,
body language.
Body language and stuff. And then other people, exactly like you said, they're like thirsty. They want to drink. And that's the way I see people who, if I was to categorize people that I've met that have converted to Islam, their starting point was not somebody coming up to them and giving them an intellectual argument. For an intellectual argument to be compelling, you have to be first be willing to listen to it. If you don't want to listen to it, it's not going to have any impact. What first really needs to hit you is, are these questions even important? And when you realize they're important, then you will take the answers seriously. And you know, you spoke about the fact that we don't want to deal with these serious questions. One of the brothers who, he's been on my channel before when I was in the UK, I did some videos with him, Jerry. He works with IRA. He used to be a militant atheist and again, a militant nihilist, right? he told me a story of an atheist who, he was a Christian, that atheist, and then that Christian became disillusioned with the faith or whatever and left Christianity. And then he was a Christian, then he was in like an atheist for like 20 years or something, some long time. And then what happened was he found out that he had cancer or something really, like, that's it, he's gonna die after a few months, whatever. And he said, when he contacted his atheist friends who were all, you know, jolly, let's go out, let's do this, let's do that, let's go on holiday, he noticed that they weren't really giving him support. And in fact, they didn't really want to talk to him. And that he found them not supportive. So then he went back to his old church, although he didn't believe in God. He went back to his old church and they welcomed him with open arms. And yet this guy actually wrote about this. Yeah. So the only way that I think people who don't take nihilism seriously can deal with suffering is, like you said, just ignore it, just outside our mind,
move to something that can give some instant gratification. So let's go buy clothes, let's go watch a film, let's go get drunk, let's go do this. And what advice can you give to someone who is an atheist about death? Like, this is the weird thing, like when I'm talking to people who have expressed disbelief to me, and when they come up to me and they're telling me that there's someone in their family that's dying, what do you say to them? Like, for me, it's like, you know, God, if you believed in God, you know, there'd be, and you were a good person, you've got something to look forward to. But when someone's dying and they don't believe in an afterlife, they don't believe in God, it's like, yeah, this is horrible. You know, like,
you know, Yusuf, I wouldn't put it in those exact terms. I would say not only atheists, I would say Muslims, atheists, and everybody else. Yes, Muslims are in a different boat from the perspective that we believe in Allah. However, a large proportion of Muslims today, they live their lives the way that non-Muslims live their lives, in from the perspective that they focus on materialism, they focus on these. Yeah. So, you know, the Prophet ﷺ, he spoke about the end times, and he spoke about how the Muslims will be completely dominated by their non-Muslim forces. And the Sahaba, they asked him, how is that going to be the case? Are we going to be small in number? And he said, no, you are going to be numerous. But he said, you're going to be like the foam of the ocean. And he said, you're going to have wahan. And the Sahaba asked, what is wahan? And he said, love of the world and hatred of death. So the Prophet, peace be upon him, here, he is saying about the Muslims, not the disbelievers. He is saying about the Muslims, they will have the love of this world, meaning materialism, and they will have the hatred of death. Now, I remember meeting somebody who was very close to death. And this is somebody who did not pray. They were completely living a hedonistic life, a completely materialistic life. They had a Muslim name. They had a Muslim cultural, a Muslim culture, but they were just living. I mean, to be honest, I can't really see a difference between them and an atheist, the way they were actually living their life. They were just Muslim by name. And when it came to the end of their life and they actually had some serious health issues, I spent a bit of time with them and I saw them go through that journey, and then eventually they died. That person didn't instantly, because all their life they were living like an atheist, but with a Muslim name. Near the end of your life, what do you start doing? You start praying. You start doing this, start doing that. But it studied the entire year. Nothing amazing is going to happen in the last 8 hours before the exam, you know, with 3 Red Bulls and 2 cups of coffee. You know, staying up all night. Yeah, it's all night. I'll do a crammer and I'll get all the information out there. No. you're not going to be able to do much. So what advice can you give to people like that? I mean, that's one of the hardest things that to deal with, is people who live their life in a very materialistic way. How do you console them near the end of their life? Especially if they have no belief, then it's totally different. But, you know, even if they have belief, yeah.
There was a friend of mine. Well, there is a friend of mine. He was in a very bad state, and he came in, and I was at my brother's place, and he'd been going on this binge for like over a month. He'd been in this really bad place where he was just partying nonstop, and he was having a lot of vision for a month.
That is cool.
And
that is crazy.
And so when I met him, he'd been awake for something, like he said, I can't remember, it was 3 days or a week where he'd not slept. He'd been on cocaine nonstop, and he'd been going to the casino. And whatever, he's not a Muslim, but whatever you think is haram, he was doing it in that week. And he came in and he told me his mother was suicidal, and his family were distancing themselves from him, and like whatever could go wrong was going wrong. And like I was looking at him, and his face was, it looked like death. I can't describe the image that he gave. Like, and he was crying, and half of his face was sunk. A guy same age as me, like he's 30, he's not an old man, and he was just, wow. Yeah, it was really terrifying. And he was just telling me all these things that were going wrong. And he, like, his missus was saying that, you know, she doesn't want him to see the kid. And is, you know, this is going on with that parent, that's going on with that other parent. Is people are dying around him. And like, I didn't know what to say to him. And it, like, it was just, he was bursting out in tears. It made me want to cry. And all I could do was just give him a hug. And that was like the extent of it. And it was, and it, like, it's hard to deal with, because it sounds like a great moment to kind of jump in there with a bit of dawah, but it just seemed incredibly inappropriate, and it would have said
that would be.
But
you know, that's why I try and get people, when I'm speaking to people. Oh, so, sorry, you were in the middle of saying something. I just interjected there.
No, sorry. It's basically, this isn't uncommon, like.
Yeah.
This is something that happens, like, and I know we're not a lot of people that this ends up happening with, and the, you know, and it's not like he began as this alcoholic or this person who was addicted to cocaine or as someone who was like a severe gambler. Like, it starts off just little bits, and it starts off with just, you know, going out for a pint on the weekend, and it starts off with, oh yeah, just one line, and then it. Or yeah, let's just put fiver in, you know, in the bookies, and like these things develop exponentially when suffering arrives, because they can't, you know, for them, when you don't believe suffering has a purpose behind it, you can't bear dealing with it, and so you have to turn away to avoid it, and this is what these things do. This is what alcohol does. This is what drugs do. This is what gambling does. It tries to turn you away from suffering rather than dealing with it. Yeah. And so for anyone who's watching now, don't shy away from just reflecting on how horrible life can be. Like, it's not something you should avoid. It is something that helps you to reconfigure what's important in your life. Like, in your last moments, is it really going to seem that important as to whether or not you went out and got drunk that night? You know, are those particular clothes that you really fancied? Is that handbag? Is that car? Is any of that going to matter when you've been told you've got 3 days to live? Like, what's important? And you need, and when you think about these things, it's going to cause suffering. It's going to cause pain, but you need to submit to it and like let it encompass you, like let it absorb you. And this is what we're avoiding at the moment with this materialism, with this kind of appeal to the dunya in every sense. Like, It's avoiding the seriousness of life, the fact of death. That philosopher that I mentioned last week, Heidegger, a central part of his book, Being in Time, he calls it being towards death. And he says that we are a being that, unlike other beings, we've got to deal with like deciding how we want to be. He uses really weird language. But we are also aware that we're going to die. And he says that in order to live a truly authentic life, you have to acknowledge that. You can't ignore it. And insofar as you do ignore it, you're not a being towards death, and you're not an authentic being. You're not making decisions based on the knowledge that one day you will die. And so he put this massive emphasis on understanding that you're moving towards your death, that every step you take, every breath you make is bringing you closer to your end. And when you do this, this massively impacts how you live your life, and that it's necessary. And doing this itself is something that it can go one of two ways. Either you can, you know, depending on what you value, it can push you to nihilism, or it can push you towards feeling meaning in the most intense form. Like, and it has this strange bittersweetness about it, like this melancholy. It's a beautiful sadness, because in order to feel, in order to be able to feel okay, or because there's this thing with people being able to just be content, and you meet these people every now and then where their life isn't an up and down. They're just, they seem really boring, but like their life is something to be envious of, because for every up, you know, there's always an equal down. For every, and this is why you should be wary of intense happiness, because there's only something little that needs to come in the way to ruin it, and you'll be equally as upset as you were happy once that happiness is taken away. And
you know,
go on.
Yeah, sorry, I just remembered something.
No, go on.
You know that actor from Home Alone?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I've forgotten his name.
McCulkin or something.
Yeah. So he went off track a few years ago. Quite a few years ago. And just went completely AWOL and drugs. And he looked like a crackhead. You know, he'd lost all this weight. And, you know, I used to watch him as a child and stuff. Anyway, he's on Twitter, by the way. And he recently came on Twitter. By recently, a few years ago. But he's got like hardly any followers. He's got like 20,000 or something. Well, that was a few years ago when I... So anyway... I'm very keen on trying to, you know, when people, they like, he's obviously got into the state that he did because of materialism, because of maybe him being sick and tired of fame and realizing it doesn't make him happy, and something to do with, you know, just life being pointless. So anyway, what I did is I tweeted him a verse of the Quran. I'm trying to remember what verse of the Quran it was. And I just copied his name in. And I just had this thing that, you know, he doesn't have that many followers, 20,000 followers. He was a famous movie star, God knows when, yeah? Maybe he'll see this tweet. And the Quranic verse was, truly in the remembrance of God do hearts find peace. And I put the Quran, like verse, chapter, whatever, or another verse. And he retweeted it. And I thought to myself, oh my God, you retweeted it. The Home Alone guy, it was this guy, and I got really happy and stuff, yeah? But then I was thinking to myself, if this guy, whatever his name was, the Home Alone guy, he's actually our age now, he's like close to 40, 38 or something. If this guy was just as famous as, say, who's famous? Brad Pitt. And if he was just as happy or whatever, he would never retweet a verse of the Quran. Not because he wouldn't see it, but you really have to be in a very down state to start to realize, okay, I need to think about meaning. I need to think about God. I need to think about purpose. You really have to hit rock bottom to take these things seriously. When you're out in the world like Brad Pitt, where you're just like an A-lister, one movie after another, constant dopamine triggers, continuously busy, you won't get into the state that the Home Alone kid did. And you won't have time to reflect about these things. Now, may Allah guide you, but I'm sure there's a lot of other people out there, even celebrities, who they've gone from, you know, like you spoke about, they're playing Fortnite, they're playing Minecraft, they're playing these games like where they control reality, to going and learning geometry, and then they feel really down. It's the same in celebrities and people that have everything, and they go from being an A-class celebrity to a C-class celebrity, and then they're thinking, what the hell is the point of everything, you know? And that's the perfect time to, you know, get people to start thinking about the purpose of life.
They have to, because whatever is in the world, it comes and it goes. There's a really good, I don't know if any of you have seen it, I don't know if you've seen this, so well, there was a documentary called Zeitgeist. And
remind me of that again. That sounds very familiar.
There's three of them. The first one was a critique of Christianity, and then it moves on to 9/11 conspiracy, and then it moves on to the monetary system. The second Zeitgeist focuses.
I heard of it. I didn't watch it.
It's really, really good. The second one focuses on the monetary system. And it begins with this excerpt, and I don't know where it's from. I think it might have been a comedian or something. But it's, if you search Zeitgeist Monopoly Scene on YouTube, it's very short. And it's basically this guy, he's talking about something his grandma taught him. And it's beautiful. Like the art behind it, the whole video itself is like, it's a really a great piece of art. And it hits hard. And he's talking about, he used to go to his grandma's every summer. And his grandma would pull out the Monopoly board, and she used to beat him every time. And he hated that, like, he couldn't ever win. And so he said one summer he went away, and he learned how to play Monopoly. He played it every day. Like he basically invested so much energy and time into it so that he could master it. And like he learned that the rules of the game was to just be ruthless, like buy everything that you can, you know, like just acquire it all. And it was all about just basically dominating in as much as possible. And he became ruthless. And so that summer he went to his grandma's and he played his grandma at Monopoly. And he beat her and he was ruthless. Like he didn't hold back. And he was really like chuffed. He'd eventually beat his grandma at Monopoly and he won the game. He'd mastered it. And then she said, I've got one more thing to teach you. And she says, in the end, no matter how much you earn, no matter how many houses, how many hotels, how much money you end up with at the end of the game, it all goes back in the box. It all turns to dust. Like it doesn't matter how much energy you've acquired and like trying to attain it all, whatever I've earned, whatever you've earned, it goes back in the box and someone else is going to play with it when you're gone, you know. And you know, and then he starts kind of transferring this to kind of this whole capitalism thing. It doesn't matter how high ladder that you climb, it doesn't matter how successful, whether you become the CEO or not, like whatever you earn in this life, eventually you'll die and it goes back in the box. And if you get a chance, watch that video. It's alhamdulillah, it's amazing. But yeah, and it's probably a nice place to end it, to be honest. If you want to read my article as well, I'll leave links in the description. I'll give Sabor the link for the dissertation as well.
And I wanted to just add to that box thing. You know, every Friday we recite what we should be reciting, or at least listening to Surah Kahf, right? Which is chapter 18, the cave. Now, I think I've mentioned this to you before about this particular, we're supposed to recite it on Fridays, and this is supposed to be protection from Dajjal. And we know Dajjal is all about materialism, right? That's his main way of getting to people. Now, what's beautiful about this verse, about this chapter, is it begins off like this, right? This is right near the beginning. Allah says, "We have adorned the earth with attractive things so that we may test people to find out which of them do best. But we shall reduce all of this to barren dust."
Allahu Akbar.
It is such a powerful thing. Allah, you know, before you give a talk, you tell them what you're going to talk about, then you talk about it, then you summarize it. Right at the beginning, you know, this surah is supposed to be protection. Protection from Dajjal, and Dajjal is all about materialism. And Allah is saying, look, it's attractive. I'm testing you. But trust me, all of this, all of the billions of buildings and people and enterprises and social media, and all of this is just going to be dust. And you know, when I read this verse many years ago, it literally was like ingrained into my bones. It just went in. I was like, that makes so much sense. We're going crazy over dust.
Yeah, and the scientist is telling you that all of this is just dust.
Yeah, that's it. You know that. You know, we're supposed to be stardust, right? Everything, like we both are in rooms right now. Everything in your room came from the earth. So you got that cupboard behind you, which is wood, that came from the earth, from wood. You have metal behind you, which came from iron ore in the ground. You have plastic, which came from sand. Your clothes came from cotton, and cotton obviously grew up from plants. Everything, including yourself, started off as basically dust. And you can go back to dust. You know what I was thinking about? I was like, this is like the antidote to materialism. Nice. Yeah.
No, it is. And I think, very good. Just to kind of finish, Nietzsche predicted that we can't go back to Christianity, that we have to go through it. He was much more open for this creative endeavor, that we have to create something new. I think that, inshallah, especially in the West, that Islam will be the antidote, and that people will incline towards it. And it is an amazing antidote, and it does where there was no meaning, it floods it with meaning, and the suffering no longer does it have no purpose. Every single bit of pain you ever feel ultimately has a massive purpose in it, and that makes it so much easier to deal with. And alhamdulillah,
I'm just laughing because we were in the IR office a few months ago, and one of the brothers was recalling, because we do these new Muslim retreats where you get all these new Muslims and then we teach them Aqeedah, fiqh, basic stuff. So these seminars are normally held over like a long weekend, and they're done by Abdul Rahim Green. He does them regularly, right? Also others but him. So anyway, one of the people at the retreat, they asked Abdul Rahim, right, how do we know Islam is true? Right? How do we know that it's true? And, you know, he just thought for a second and he goes, it works. We were laughing about this in the office, right? And there's some brothers who were like, oh, you know, but then I was thinking about it. I was like, if you apply what Allah says to you in the Quran, trust in Allah, zikr of Allah, giving life to the heart, or these types of things, it does work, but it doesn't just work in a crude scientific way, right? It works deep within you. You know it's the truth, and you know you're on the right path. So it's not just some, you know, you can't apply the problem induction on it, right? It's like something, the way I think about it is, you know, like a magnet just attracts to the other magnet, right? The human heart, you can give the human heart 1,000 different meanings. You can say the meaning of life according to Buddhism is this, Hinduism is this, Taoism is this, Taoism is this, Judaism is this. But when Islam gives you that meaning, it's like, okay, that makes sense. It fits. And I think that is something that we really need to infuse into the Dawah, because maybe you feel the same way, Yusuf, but I think the Dawah has become hyper-rationalized.
Yeah, and this is one of the issues as well, because in my article, I mentioned this, that one of the issues with the history of philosophy, specifically Western philosophy, is you've got this history of constantly trying to rationalize God. And the thing is rational, or being reason itself and logic, the way it works is it's compartmentalized, it's bits, it's mechanical, it's this bit fits into this. And it's something that only really applies to the material realm. When you're trying to deal with the infinite, this thing that's not mechanical, it's not parts that fit together, it's not a machine, it's the source of all of this. It's trying to break it down into things in the same way you would do with finite things doesn't do it justice. Like sort of to class, you know, there's nothing comparable to him. He is infinite. Yeah. He is eternal. And don't be surprised that like reason and logic, and this isn't to say that there aren't good arguments for it, and that, you know, that, like, for example, that you can lead to certain truths with reason, like the Kalam and things like that. I do incline towards these arguments and I do like them. I just don't think that everyone is hyper rational. I don't think everyone is capable of even understanding these, because the arguments for God themselves are complex. The rebuttals of them they end up being quite more complex. And you have this kind of increasing in complexity. And then you've got arguments, positive arguments, that the atheist might put forward as reasons why God doesn't exist. And then the responses to them become more complex. And the language is very esoteric. It's very elitist. Like, this isn't, and it's boring a lot of the time. Like, to go through all of this, like, it's hard to keep your eyes open reading some of these books. Like, they can get tedious and lengthy, and, you know, they've been going on for generations. And for Nietzsche, this was one of the problems with the Western philosophical history, is that they spent so much time trying to like rationalize something that might not even be possible to rationalize, whether or not it exists. Even if it exists, it might be so grand that to think that you, a finite being, could do it justice with a couple of page argument, like, you must be arrogant to think this. Yeah. And it's so I'm not trying to push people away from engaging in reason and rationality and things like that. You know, that it has its uses. It is important. It's not something that should just be neglected, because this is one of the issues with this YOLO mentality, this hedonism. It's all about dealing just with your emotions, like, oh, I want this, my desire this, I desire that. No, you need to combat these with reason. You need to use your brain. You need to think. You need to, but there needs to be a balance between the two. You can't, like, you've got one extreme over there, which is just a hyper hedonist who just fulfills desires and isn't bothered with reason. You know, the super artist, I'm just emotions and I feel this and I feel that, and that's what matters. And then on the other extreme, you've got the hyper-objectivist who just flushes all meaning out of the world completely. Emotion is just a burden. All of these things don't matter. And it's not about these extremes. There is a middle path. There is a way of not, but the understanding there's a utility in looking at the world objectively, and, you know, gaining knowledge this way and utilizing the sciences to produce knowledge. But there's also a utility in understanding that we are, as human beings, emotional beings, that we have emotional needs, that we have social needs, that we get lonely, that we get sad, that even the scientist cannot escape this, as much as he might like to talk as though humanity would be great if he could. If you remove emotion, if you remove subjectivity, you've removed what makes us human. Like we are driven by meaning. We are driven by what settles our heart, not necessarily what just gives us pleasure, but what can make us content. And that's what we need to aim at. We need to aim not at these lives that provide these big ups of super highs that inevitably end up followed with massive downs and super lows and depression. You need to aim at being peaceful, content, and gain a middle ground, and be wary of excitement. Be wary of these bursts of adrenaline, and, you know, the things like the people who end up winning the lottery, they get this massive, intense pleasure from it to begin with. And you get a lot of them, especially when they come from like council estates and things like that, they lose it all. And the down that they feel is equivalent to the up that they felt. They've lost
a drug.
Yeah. And, you know, if for those who have tried drugs, the same applies for that as well. When you've gone on a night of cocaine and alcohol, you feel amazing at one point, and it always is followed by what they refer to as a come down. You always end up having to deal with the opposite side of the coin once all of that happiness is worn off. So be wary of it. Don't get pulled in by this rubbish about be free, do what you want. There's consequences. A wise man doesn't have to learn from his own mistakes. He can learn from the mistakes of other people. And
absolutely,
just keep that in mind. Like, don't make people convince you that you need to make your own, because you don't. You can look at other people and what they've done and utilize that in your own life. But
And I think that's a good thing to end upon, because that lifestyle which you just described, that is Aleister Crowley's Thelema religion, because his book of law, he says,
Do what
shall be the whole of the law. And I love that, because that is the Nike slogan, just do it. You know, it doesn't matter what people think, feel.
He's also a massive influence to a lot of the major pop stars.
Around you, what your own...
Oh, sorry, you broke up then. Did I talk?
He is, you said he's a massive influence to the pop stars.
Yeah, like Lady Gaga and that.
The last Led Zeppelin and Beatles, they also sort of influenced by him. One of the most influential Britons, the 100 most influential Britons, some things that one of the newspapers, or I don't know, one of these things actually did. So anyway, Jazakallah khair, Yusuf. We're going to be doing, inshallah, another one on nihilism again. This is an extremely important topic. The way I think about it is that before you start a building project, you need tendering. You need people arguing about, okay, who's going to win the contract? Conveying Islam in the 21st century is, whoever you are, we need to start on the topic of meaning and the topic of purpose, value, hope, you know, essentially nihilism. That's what you really need to begin, and then segue that to why Islam is true. And next time we're going to be covering part two of the dissertation. If you haven't read it, please start reading it, and definitely read the part that we covered today, because I don't think we covered all of it. We just covered bits and bobs and sort of just gave a few thoughts on it. But Jazakallah khair, Yusuf, for joining us on this collaboration. And Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.